Visioneers, Episode 9. Enter the World Leaders.
Well, it's time to recap. You, the listener, as participant, have set out in your mind to change the world. You've created your thinking room. You've brought in your four mentors, Churchill, Kennedy, Dickens, and Anne. You've created the visionaries, some 20 of them. Mark Venture has emerged as leader. And there is a plan afoot to create a Congress of the Global Mind. It's still undefined, but it's a way to build a new world order. And it's much more than a UN meeting of leaders.
Yes. Churchill's plan, you'll remember, is to tie this in to a real meeting of the leaders at the United Nations in 6 months' time. And moreover, the idea is to kidnap the leaders and bring them into the...
What? Kidnap the leaders?
Yes, sure. This is the real coup of the story, to bring the leaders into the visioneering room and give them an extraordinary experience. And, of course, in the meantime, the visioneers must first of all go out and start changing the world.
And this is what they do. They have sorties into Russia, China, India, Africa, Scotland, the United States, Canada, Australia, and France. However, the major initiative in all this was taken by Luis Valdez in Chile. He first broadcasts to the world via satellite, and this initial broadcast, if you remember, was brought to UNESCO. This caused them to pass a resolution to support the work of the visioneers. A second broadcast creates a situation where there are orders given by El Condor to kill Luis. And in the third broadcast, it begins with a description of what needs to be done to make the world a better place, and ends with a terrible murder of Luis in a scene watched by millions of people around the world.
Yes, and while all of this was going on in Chile, there was a parallel stream of events happening in Israel. A friend of Esther Fisher's, David Roth, had his apartment blown up by Palestinians. And then Esther and her friend, Jenny Lovix, were captured by terrorists. And Mark and Mohammed Hussein, along with David Roth, freed the two women from their captors. And after that then came the beginning of Mark and Esther's romance.
Well, the climax to this part of the story came with the memorial service for Luis Valdez. Thousands of people came to watch, millions also watched on TV. There were speeches by Cardinal Vecchiano, by George Cardinal, Baba Satyananda, and by Mark. And this whole scene ends with Teresa singing the Song of the Visioneers.
So, that's where we are. All of this has taken about a month to happen, and now Mark, at the end of this initial period, now gives himself and his team 150 days to go out and make a difference. And so it begins. A headquarters is set up in Los Angeles, and money begins to pour in, and a program in creative learning is established with various outlets across the world. And George Walker, one of the American team of visioneers, gets his organization called the Planetary Business Network behind the whole initiative.
Well, the visioneers' projects are set up around the world. Visioneers' flags emerge. They are blue with a white world and big V on them, and they're found waving above clubhouses, dens, secret hideaways. There's all kinds of community activity. There is a particular initiative which is led by Diane Koplitz and Esther Fisher, in which supports women moving to become full partners with men. And Indira Murchie and Carmen Santander become as popular and well-known as film and TV stars. And so the stories of dramatic accomplishments abound. Children are banding together to clean contaminated swimming holes. Senior citizens are coming out of retirement to build and manage their own housing complexes. Displaced workers are creating self-help communities where their different skills and talents are brought together in new enterprises. Middle-class suburbanites are venturing into the inner city and ghettos to develop a shared vision with the residents of what their community could be, and they're beginning to take action to accomplish it. Success stories and positive things begin to emerge with equal importance to news of the violent and the bizarre. And indeed, it seems to be becoming the reason for increased sales of newspapers and periodicals.
And there's another thrust as well, led by Arthur Rheingold, who you'll remember was a film producer. And he came up with the idea of establishing a film to record the story of the Visioneers. And it turns out that it's going to be a three-part series. And part one will be the story up to the memorial service for Louis Valdez. And this is shown around the world, and it sparks a new surge of activity. And then it's followed with an international exposition for peace, and this is a very large-scale activity in which 100,000 people gather together on an airstrip in Britain, which was part of the war effort in the Second World War. And what they're celebrating is 50 years of peace rather than 50 years of war. And this is all linked up with other initiatives in education. And so the whole thing is swelling continuously over the 150-day period. The only place where activity is rather slow and uneven is in the government sector.
People seem to be searching for something beyond themselves, for relationships of meaning. And in this, the spotlight settles on Mark and Esther. There never seems to be enough time for them. And Esther is very cautious because of her previous marriage. Mark is more pressing, but also has a previous marriage in his background. In any case, the stage is set for their relationship, and in early February, they have some time for themselves. We get a touching romantic scene on the Costa del Sol on Spain's Mediterranean coastline.
They had stolen time away from appearances on behalf of the Visioneers and driven down by rental car from Madrid. In grateful anonymity as just another English couple, they checked into a small hotel, then made their way to the beach to catch the last hour of sunshine on a cool February afternoon. Well rugged up in duffel coats and sweaters, they had the beach to themselves, save for a few seagulls wheeling and dipping just above the surface of a calm and easy sea. At this part of the shoreline, the beach swung around in a gentle arc up to a headland of jumbled rocks, creating the effect of a secluded lagoon edged with pure white sand. Hand in hand, they walked along the empty beach until they came to the rocks, then sat in a sheltered spot beside the largest boulder to watch the sun setting over the headland on the opposite side of the lagoon. "Do you know the captain's verses of Pablo Neruda?" Mark asks.
"No, tell me."
"They're love poems, written in Spanish. Though not from here. He was Chilean, I think. Anyway, they come to mind in this beautiful place. He wrote forcefully in brilliant earthy images of his fiery love for the woman who later became his wife. But he kept the source of the poems a mysterious secret for many years before he claimed them as his own. He wanted, he said, to be loyal to the ecstasies of love and fury."
"By keeping the poems secret?"
"Yes, they were too close to his heart to share."
"Except with a loved one."
"Yes."
"I understand that."
There's a silence. Then Mark says, "I have a new poem for you."
"Yes, I thought as much. You've written me so many, they quite blow me away."
"Would you like to hear it?"
"Of course."
"It's a bit crumpled, I'm afraid. I wrote it last night in Madrid and stuffed it in my coat pocket. I thought I might find the right place to read it to you." He pulls a sheet of paper out of the inside pocket of his coat.
The crumpled love poem.
It's called Daring. How much to dare and why? Good questions for all who seek to act. It's not enough to blindly venture forth as many have done with multiple regret. Neither is it right to withdraw from playing in the main event to which you have been called. Knowing how to tell is the main issue. To be sure you have heard correctly the higher inner voice and are not deceived by some lesser part of ego. Usually such decisions touch others in your life, which calls for planning to accommodate. And when the decision involves another who is pursuing an equally urgent quest, how much more important to be right? If involvement grows to love and the deep bonding of two spirits, a change ensues. How much to dare becomes less a question and more a search for the higher part of self found only in the other. If that's discovered and grows in strength, then daring becomes attaining. New levels of experience are reached as old boundaries are crossed and fresh horizons sought. Questions of how much to dare and why are answered in the daring. And the whole world opens because two people dared to find the passage for their love. He finishes reading and looks across at Esther, who had tucked her legs under her and sat staring intently into his face as he read. He sees her eyes shining in the last rays of the setting sun.
It's beautiful, Mark, and true. Your truth.
It can be our truth, too, if we dare to take the path together. Silence settles again. A lone gull in the fading light seems to notice that his mate has left and calls raucously, wheeling up into the air and heading off across the water in search of the other. Esther takes an envelope carefully from her purse. It's not crumpled. She withdraws a card. In the soft light, Mark sees on its cover the picture of a red rose, fully opened.
I have one for you, too.
Mark waits silently. She reads the inside of the card, though hardly needing to look, the words seeming fresh in her mind.
It's called Yes. Yes is an affirmation built on a thousand no's. No to death, pain, sickness, sadness, and bad compromise. No to lethargy, fuzzy thinking, mediocrity, and boredom. Yes begins with the intention to take little yes steps. Yes to vigor, to strength and striving, to hard work and homework, to study and learning and thinking, to writing and being. Yes to embarking on journeys, to questing and questions. Yes to dancing and singing, to poetry, music, and laughter. Yes to feeling and friendship, to well-being, to good food and good drinking, to beach walks, to popcorn and movies, to fireside chats and pillow talking. Yes to fun places, to wilderness spaces, to mountains and climbing, to playing and dreaming, to planning and deep seeing. And when the chorus of yeses ring out in celebration, fueling the heart with wild courage, it's easy to take little yes steps, to say yes to growing, to being, to soaring, to living, to loving, to me, to you, to us. So I can, I will, and I do.
Looking across the tiny space between them on the beach, their eyes lock in a soul embrace. The poems flutter from their hands onto the sand as they come together, man and woman, in the full and long lover's kiss of a forever consent to be together. They gather up the poems from the sand and walk slowly as one back along the beach to their hotel.
Shortly afterwards, their engagement is announced, and the wedding is set for the middle of April in Jerusalem.
Well, now we leave Mark and Esther and move to a completely new and different development. You link your imaginary world of visioneers now with the real world of the heads of state meeting at the UN headquarters in New York.
Is this the one where Churchill wants you to kidnap the leaders?
Yes, that's right. And so it begins by you, the listener, the participant, the creator of all of this marvelous activity, tuning in to the TV coverage of the UN meeting. And as Churchill had predicted, no real progress is made. You listen for someone from the developed world to admit that their science and technology have led them astray in expecting too much of the world to meet unlimited demands for material consumption. But there is no such admission. Instead, you hear the implicit belief that new technology will do what the old could not. You understand that these leaders are willing to move ahead into a precarious future with untested assumptions of meeting increasing demands. In vain you listen for a leader from a poorer nation to describe a new understanding of the quality of life that might be reasonable for all people on the fragile planet. Nowhere is there a sense that people themselves can make enlightened decisions in these matters if given the means to do so. All solutions are couched in a continuation of conflict between have-not and have for a dwindling supply. Everywhere there are grand speeches calling for peace. Nowhere is there condemnation of members sitting in the assembly who head up regimes of terror responsible for unspeakable atrocities. All is bland. All is banal. All thinking is based on a continuation of the conflicting self-interest of sovereign states. Nowhere is there an understanding that the Earth and its ecology is a single, seamless whole and that it cannot indefinitely withstand the pressures of a powerful human species that tears it apart, piece by piece. It's the end of the second day of a four-day conference. No progress has been made. The leaders have decided to go into closed session. You turn off your television set, close your eyes, and enter your thinking room.
So the mentors return, excited by everything that has happened. They cheer you on, Charles Dickens particularly enthusiastic, and he's keen now to bring on the Scrooge experience.
And the next piece will be stupendous. We're going to put these world leaders through a Scrooge experience. I mean to say, if the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future could transform that quintessential, most miserable of misers, that squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, if I may quote myself, if the spirits could transform him into as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as a good old city knew, or any good old city, town, or borough in the good old world, to quote myself again, if that could be done for the good of everyone who reads the story, then think of what we can do here by showing the leaders what lies in store for them and the world if they don't change their ways. By Jove, I can hardly wait to get at them.
Well, now the mentors leave and you go back to watching TV. The heads of state have already moved to private session. You catch the words of a small white-haired gentleman speaking about spiritual mind change.
Human minds are connected in mysterious ways we don't understand. They can share images of hatred and war just as vividly as they can share images of love and peace. And the images most strongly held determine what happen. Knowing this, we must enjoin with all possible haste a worldwide visioning of peace and cooperation with the greatest possible clarity of the specifics for action. Such vivid communal imagining of positive images for fruitful coexistence with each other and the earth will do more to ensure its coming to pass
than all the most brilliant policies or profound scientific theories. Millions of people affirming a positive vision is the most powerful force on Earth.
My God! What if those world leaders knew and understood that? What if they bent all their efforts to freeing people's minds to invent a positive future for all of us? You're galvanized into action to make that happen. And now there's an amazing scene of 100 world leaders arriving on Silver Bridge, coming into the visioneering room. It's winter. They've come from a heated room. They're irate and angry. Almost everyone is muttering something as they come up to you. They're talking in languages you don't understand, but you keep smiling and greeting them in English, and they keep coming. Some of the looks they give you are as black as thunder. People keep pushing and jostling. Some are standing straight, others, two of them are in wheelchairs, moved by others. They all seem to be huddled against the cold. They keep on coming for 15 or 20 minutes until all of them have passed by, entering the visioneering center. Well, now you follow behind and step into the visioneering room. It's an amazing sight what happens next. The room is in an uproar. Everywhere people are defiant. Their anger is increasing with a warmth. They're convinced it's a hoax. They can't see how this has been done. Clearly, you can expect little tolerance from this group. You know you have in this room the most powerful people on the earth. And they sense somehow they've been stripped of rank and privileges and thrown together in a melee of confusion and indignation. Well, you welcome them to this room, and you tell them that the mentors will soon be addressing them. A profound hush has descended as you've spoken. Everyone in the visioneering room hears the speech in his or her own language, so the full force of your words has registered in every mind. The air hangs heavy with judgment. You pause a moment, scanning every eye in the three rows of seating, looking down to the center. The silence is thunderous. Then you leave, and the floor stands empty. Shimmering. Suddenly, into that space, striding out of history, comes the unmistakable figures of a Winston Spencer Churchill and John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The response of the assembly is immediate. Gasps of amazement and disbelief explode on all sides. Churchill, in full morning dress, waistcoated and keychained, his unlit cigar stuck in the corner of his mouth, comes to halt full center of the room and stands feet apart, staring roguishly up at them.
I thought, Mr. President, that we had entered the bear pit, but I see that all the bears are in the gallery.
John Kennedy is beside him in blue pinstripe business suit, flashing his broadest, most engaging smile.
Oh, I rather thought, Mr. Prime Minister, that this was heaven and the choir had assembled to sing us in.
Some choir. Yeah, the Bear Country Jamboree.
Well, now, Churchill opens the session with the following address.
I always like a noisy house. It obviates the necessity for close attention. However, I suggest that on this occasion you may wish to listen carefully to words that come, so to speak, from the other side.
He has their attention now, and he continues by reviewing the sliding path of civilization.
And the consequences already are apparent to those who have eyes to see. They show in the poisoned soil on every continent, in the polluted oceans washing every shore, in the thickening congested air above every sprawling megalopolis. They cry out in the anguish of the homeless and the unemployed, not only in the poorest countries, but also in the richest places on earth. They lurk with shame in the furtive, skulking alleys of the ghettos, in the stealthy, sordid dealings of the drug pushers, in the alcohol-dazed murders on the native reservations. But worse than all, they linger in the hearts and minds of people who are the beneficiaries of the most elaborate educational systems the world has ever known. Everywhere, such men and women go about their daily life filled with a growing sense of uneasiness and fearfulness, but unable to catch the vision of a brighter, cleaner, better future, and powerless to act to break out of their patterns of dependence and conformity. The time to stem that tide is now at hand, and the responsibility for engineering the machinery to do it lies squarely on the shoulders of every one of you behind those benches. Yet, what do? You sit in endless debate in the United Nations and paralyze it with indifference. Those of you who hold your office as a mandate from the people scan the polls for your re-election, and those who stand as petty dictators surround yourselves with things to hold your power. Well, we are here to tell you the time has run out for continued toleration of that state of affairs. The world is in upheaval, and you will be caught and crushed in the vortex of the storm unless you act now to make a change. People are on the move and will no longer tolerate leadership or indifference or tyranny. They are banding together as visionaries, still small in number, but growing rapidly as their minds are touched by the rediscovered power of their imaginations to create a future different from where your policies are leading. This is your hour of trial. You can choose now to keep your heads buried in the sand, or you can lift them up to find again, as we did when the hell angels stalked the earth, that there's one bond that unites you all. This time, it's not the bond of war against a brutish enemy, but the bond of vision to see a new world order rising out of the chaos of this one now passing. With such a vision, you will show your leadership by bringing your people to see it too and empowering them to act, to do whatever it takes to bring it to pass. This you must do, and do it now. To do less is to fail, and to fail is to sink into the oblivion of a life that is no life at all.
And then Kennedy speaks.
Let there be no confusion. You must see the vision before you can achieve it. Let there be no question that the vision must be shared in the minds and hearts, not only of each one of you here, but of every living soul in your constituencies. Let there be no doubt that this is the task of statesmanship. And let there be no fear that it can't be done because anything less is insufficient to the high moral purpose for which the human race exists. Let the word go forth from this assembly that you will bend every effort, commit every resource, make every pledge, support every initiative, and condemn every opposition to assure the building and the proclamation of the New World Vision. To this great vision of universal peace, fellowship, and prosperity for all, I urge you now to make your stand, and never, never, never give up until it becomes a reality in your time and for all time to come.
Hardly before the president has uttered the last words, a sudden change sweeps into the room. The sound of a roaring wind fills the air. The president steps aside, and in an instant, his place is taken by a shimmering, shifting earthscape of cloud and sky, ocean and land, open fields, forest, and snow-capped mountains. Then it shifts again into a densely packed city square filled with people, many tens of thousands milling around, their faces quizzical and concerned, as if searching for something lost or beyond their grasp. The scene turns over and over, but always filled now with people searching. In many lands, many settings, different cultures, different nationalities at work, in agriculture, industry, offices, linked by communication systems of computers, satellites, aircraft, and all manner of vehicles. Suddenly the people are gone, and a single tall building comes into view in the distance, but zooming in quickly until it fills the space and can be recognized. It's the United Nations building in New York. Tall, glass, the Plaza of Nations and the flags. The scene moves inside to the doors of the General Assembly. They're closed, security guards in place. It moves through the doors into the room. A gasp goes up from the leaders in the visioneering room as they see themselves in session from which they were brought. They are all there, each one behind the country name, but nothing is happening. It's fixed frame. There's no sound or movement, no speech or action. Everything is still. The scene moves from face to face along the rows of delegates. They're all there, but immobile, lifeless, seemingly without thought or energy. Suddenly, they're gone. Papers, briefs, personal effects all remain, but every delegate is gone. Every seat is empty. Every seat but one, the chair of the Secretary General. The figure there rises. It's a man. He moves down onto the floor of the assembly alone in that empty space. The rest of the scene fades, and he's now standing on the floor of the visioneering room, looking up into the wide-eyed, uncomprehending faces of the leaders of almost every nation on the earth.
Good morning. My name is Charles Dickens. I'm to be your host for the remainder of your time with us in the visioneering room.
He is dressed as usual, 19th century casual and slightly theatrical. Gray slacks, long green cutaway jacket, yellow waistcoat, and heavy gold watch chain. His long hair and wispy beard frame the lively dancing energy of his eyes and face. Hands in pockets, he strolls casually around the space, using it like a stage. Well then, there is an uproar among the crowd saying, "Are you the novelist, Charles Dickens?" And he says, "Yes, at your service." Well then, they really begin to object. They shout, "Rubbish! I've never heard such drivel. Who do you think you are to stand there and talk to people about our responsibilities, about visioneers and a visioning mind? There's a real world out there full of real problems, and all your visioning isn't going to change that one bit. Talk to the hungry people in my country about visioning food on their plate. Don't waste our time. End this charade now and let us get back to our real work." He's right. Yes, I agree. Come on, we've had enough of this.
Oh, no, you haven't. We've hardly yet begun.
This was an explosive roar from Winston Churchill, who had leapt to his feet at the start of the interjections and is now standing defiantly in the center of the room beside Charles Dickens. John Kennedy is on his feet, too, moving towards them.
You say you have problems now. Well, I will tell you, you haven't seen the like of the problems still to come. I stood alone in my time because I could see in my mind where the course of events was taking us, and all around me, mealy-mouthed men made plaintive supplication to the most treacherous swine ever let loose in international affairs. That way of closing the mind to the real consequences of actions very nearly brought freedom to the grave. Now the hounds of hell are baying again. But this time, they're hiding in the useless, protracted debate by men like you, and women too, who won't open your eyes to see what must be done before it's too late. Well, we will show you here, and if needs be, we'll grip you by the throat and shake your head until your brains rattle. But show you we will, and act you will, because the great and glorious energy of the human race will never be cut off from its path to destiny.
Bravo, Winston, bravo! John Kennedy is applauding. And where are the rest of you if you believe in the right of free men and women to come together across every boundary and division to save the world? Then I call upon you to stand now and be counted.
Yes!
Here, here!
Okay!
We're with you!
Well said!
And so, a chorus begins to build, with some people standing now applauding, then spreading like a wave along the rows. The applause building, others uncomfortable still sitting looking away, but the applause continues to build, reaching a crescendo as the reluctant ones struggle to their feet, until all three rows are standing, applauding, looking down onto the three figures standing at the center of the room.